Acute flaccid myelitis is in the media a lot lately. It has been likened to polio, and cases seem to be on the rise. I'm Dr. Matthew Stanbrook, deputy editor for the Canadian Medical Association Journal. Today, I'm speaking with one of the authors of a practice article published in the CMAJ on acute flaccid myelitis. Dr. Peter Gill is a general pediatrician and researcher at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto. He's joining me today to discuss the latest clinical information on this rare but serious condition. Peter, welcome.
Hi, Matthew. Thanks for having me on the podcast today.
Great to have you. And Peter, I should mention up front that you and I knew each other before this because you are one of the members of our editorial advisory board at CMAJ. And so given that, I just want to make it clear to our listeners that Peter was not involved in the decision-making process for this article that he authored or in the editing process at any point. And Peter, you had some help from some colleagues in writing this, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right. So I just want to acknowledge my co-authors, Dr. Ari Bittinen, who's a pediatric infectious disease physician at SickKids, and Dr. Anne Ye, who's a pediatric neurologist at SickKids as well. And they're both real content experts on acute flaccid myelitis. And I want to thank them for their help with this article.
And we certainly appreciate their contribution and yours on this article. So let's get right into it. Peter, what is acute flaccid myelitis?
So before we talk about acute flaccid myelitis, we need to step back and discuss acute flaccid paralysis. So acute flaccid paralysis is a syndrome of rapid muscle weakness. Historically, the most well-known cause of acute flaccid paralysis was polio, which fortunately has been nearly eradicated worldwide. However, acute flaccid paralysis can be due to several etiologies, such as Guillain-Barré, muscle disorders, and systemic diseases. Acute flaccid myelitis, however, is a specific type of acute flaccid paralysis, which is due to an injury to the anterior horn cells of the spinal cord. In acute flaccid myelitis, muscle weakness is a hallmark presenting feature.
So this is a subtype of acute flaccid paralysis, like what polio and other things can cause. But what causes acute flaccid myelitis in these waves of epidemics we've seen in recent years, including right now?
That's a good question. So with the near eradication of polio viruses, other non-polio enteroviruses are the predominant cause of acute flaccid myelitis in children. There's a strong association with peak enterovirus infections and clusters of acute flaccid myelitis. In particular, specific enterovirus strains, such as EVD68 and EVA71, have emerged as the predominant viruses associated with acute flaccid myelitis. EVD68 was likely responsible for the 2014 and 2016 clusters of acute flaccid myelitis in North America. But thus far, so in this 2018, there's not been a clear culprit implicated in this cluster.
So we've been hearing about it in the media and in the medical literature now because of these epidemics, including the current one. Why now is this happening? Why weren't we hearing about this a decade or two ago? It seems it's only been in the last sort of 5 to 10 years that we've seen this. So why is that?
Yeah, so sporadic cases of acute flaccid myelitis are certainly not new or unusual. What's really new is that in the past 6 to 8 years, there have been several clusters of cases during the late summer and early fall in North America and in other places. And these clusters have coincided with the usual enterovirus season, which in the Northern Hemisphere usually is during the late summer and early fall. Really, the first major cluster was in 2014 with a large number of cases in California and Colorado. But in the same year, we also had reported cases in Canada and British Columbia, Alberta, Manitoba, Ontario, and Nova Scotia. And these clusters tend to occur more in a biannual pattern, with a spike in 2016 and again in 2018 with our current clusters. And so we talk a lot about poliovirus and these currently non-polio enteroviruses, but it's important to keep in mind that polioviruses are actually a type of enterovirus. So acute flaccid myelitis is somewhat similar to poliovirus. There are some important distinctions. I think it's important that non-polio enteroviral infections are very common in children, but a very small number result in acute flaccid myelitis. On the other hand, when we had large cases of poliovirus that led to acute flaccid paralysis, approximately 0.1% of affected patients developed acute flaccid paralysis, which is quite high for a serious outcome. But so far, these acute flaccid myelitis cases, while they're coming up, they're still quite rare.
So they are quite rare, but they're happening, it seems, in more prominent clusters than in previous years. Do we know why this has happened recently as opposed to before, in terms of where these particular virulent or more pathogenic strains of enterovirus have come from to be causing this now?
Unfortunately, no. We don't have a sense of why in the past 6 to 8 years there's been an increase in these clusters of cases, particularly in 2014, 16, and 18. That's still quite unknown, and there's still a lot of further research to be done to understand why this has happened. And cases are also not unique to North America. There have also been other cases reported in Europe, Japan, China, and Taiwan. So it's a phenomenon that we don't fully understand, and there's lots of active research going on to this area.
And you mentioned that it comes from the same family as polio. Do we know whether these particular strains that are causing the clusters now evolved from polio, or are they just in the same family that have evolved on their own to become more virulent so that they start to behave like polio? Is that known?
At this stage, it's not known yet. And I think the challenge is that there's been associations where we suspect that these enteroviruses are associated with a spike in clusters of cases. But in many cases in children that are affected, the enterovirus is not isolated from the cerebrospinal fluid or from the patient at all in other specimens. Really, I think enterovirus D68 was strongly associated with the 2014 cluster, but really at this stage, it's largely associations, and we don't really have a true causative etiology. In terms of the evolution over time, again, that's similarly, we don't have a good understanding of why now, whether there's been new mutations that have happened. There's, I think, more questions than answers at this phase.
All right. Well, let's talk about how to recognize this disease. Who does it typically affect, and how does it present usually?
So acute fasciitis myelitis typically affects children between the ages of 4 and 15 years. In over 90% of cases, there's a preceding nonspecific viral illness, such as an upper respiratory tract infection or a fever. Then over the next 2 to 4 days, patients develop sudden onset limb weakness. The weakness is often associated with pain, paresthesias, and areflexia. It's also important to note that around 25% of these patients will also have cranial nerve abnormalities, such as a facial droop associated with the lower motor neuron, cranial nerve 7 palsy, and brainstem involvement, such as difficulty swallowing or with handling secretion.
So how do children get this infection? How is it spread?
So enterovirus can cause many different clinical syndromes, including a mild respiratory tract infection or a cold, gastroenteritis, hand, foot, mouth disease, or herpangina. The vast majority of these infections are mild and do not lead to any serious complications. And these viruses are mostly spread through direct or indirect contact with respiratory droplets or via the fecal-oral route.
So if a physician in a primary care clinic or an emergency department or a pediatrician, if they suspect that acute flaccid myelitis may be going on, what diagnostic tests are ordered to identify this problem?
So if a physician suspects acute flaccid myelitis in a clinic, the patient should be urgently sent to an emergency department, and if they're well, ideally to a tertiary care setting. Similarly, if a physician in the emergency department is seeing a patient with suspected acute flaccid myelitis, they should try and arrange the can urgent transfer to a tertiary care setting. These patients require further specialized infectious workup and neuroimaging. In particular, they require an MRI with contrast of the brain and the spine to look for the typical gray matter lesions that we see in acute flaccid myelitis. Usually after the MRI, there's a more detailed infectious workup that follows, including a lumbar puncture and respiratory and stool samples to look for infectious agents, which are mainly enteroviruses. U.S. Centers for Disease Control Prevention has developed a specific case definition of AFM, which is helpful to get an understanding of what we look for diagnosis. So we suspect the case is confirmed when there's acute focal limb weakness and the typical MRI findings, or it's probable if we see the limb weakness with the CSF pleocytosis.
You alluded, I think, earlier to Guillain-Barré syndrome as being a cause of a similar syndrome. How do clinicians in practice distinguish between Guillain-Barré syndrome and acute flaccid myelitis?
That's a good question, and they can seem very similar on clinical presentation. The main differences are that classically, Guillain-Barré syndrome presents with symmetric and ascending weakness, whereas acute flaccid myelitis, on the other hand, usually has asymmetric weakness, and it's usually unilateral. often there's also findings on the MRI. So typically in acute fasciomyelitis, an MRI will show T2 hyperintensities in the gray matter of the spinal cord and often enhancement of the nerve roots. But in Guillain-Barré syndrome, while we see nerve root enhancement, there is no spinal cord gray matter involvement.
So that highlights the importance of MRI in this situation then. What should happen next?
So because acute fasciomyelitis can progress quite rapidly, it should be considered and managed as a medical emergency. So urgent referral to tertiary care center is warranted because around 24 to 52% of these patients need to be admitted to the intensive care unit either for ventilatory support and nutritional support. In terms of treatment, unfortunately, to date, nothing has clearly been shown to be effective in patients. In practice, treatments are usually considered on a case-by-case basis and guided by specialty involvement, usually pediatric neurology and infectious diseases. These include treatments such as high-dose intravenous steroids, intravenous immune globulin or IVIG, and then sometimes plasmapheresis.
Can you go a little more into what situations might lead you to want to use therapies like that and what situations you would deem that it would not be required to use such therapies?
So it really, in general, each patient's considered on an individual basis. Again, treatments in terms of their invasiveness, the specific types of treatment depend on how severe the case is. So if a child has mild unilateral limb weakness and otherwise seems well, in some cases, it may be suggested to start with steroids. In other cases, if the child is quite unwell and is in the intensive care unit, with significant weakness, is on with ventilatory support, often in that case, more invasive treatments are considered, such as plasmapheresis. Really, on treatments guided by specialty involvement, and there have not been any specific guidelines or recommendations to guide treatment-specific situations because none of them have been considered to be effective in the majority of cases. So really, it comes down to specialty services to help guide what they feel is the most appropriate treatment for the patient, guided by each clinical presentation.
So when a child who presents with limb weakness, what is the time period in which they're in danger of progressing to needing ventilatory support if they're going to, and the time beyond which they would be deemed to be safe? Do you have to monitor them hospital and do vital capacity measurements the way we would do in Guillain-Barré syndrome, for example?
So certainly they need to be in a hospitalized setting and to be monitored quite closely. And from there, most of the cases in the literature, in general, the evolution has been over 2 to 4 days. So certainly if there's going to be an acute deterioration, it will happen within that time frame. So in general, if it's been a week or longer and there has not been progression, then it's likely that they will not progress further. However, in these cases, again, there's been a lot of individual variation and clinical severities have ranged. So it's important, I think, to err on the side of caution for longer times in terms of admissions. There is not clear guidelines in terms of monitoring forced vital capacity, for example. But certainly, if there's a concern from a respiratory standpoint, it would certainly be reasonable to do that. Although in children, depending on the age, that can be difficult to do in practice. But certainly, having a high index of suspicion and close vital sign monitoring is incredibly important in these patients.
Certainly. So once the acute illness resolves, what are the long-term complications of this disease?
So most patients, unfortunately, do have some form of lasting impairments. The studies so far that have looked at patients from the 2014-16 clusters have described persistent deficits in most children after 4 to 6 months follow-up, with full recovery in only around 8 to 18% of patients. Further, around 8 to 14% of patients have either required assisted devices for ambulation or complete dependence on caregivers. At this stage also, because it's been fairly recent, the cases, we don't have a long-term follow-up beyond 6 to 12 months of age. Fortunately, there have been no deaths reported in 2018. In the U.S., there were 2 deaths reported in 2014 and 1 in 2017. So while children can be quite unwell and quite sick, very few children have died.
And would it be fair to say that getting the patient to a tertiary care center would be a critical factor in determining if they live or die?
I think that would be very important just because often of the number of patients that require intensive care support, I think is an indication that many of these patients can progress quite quickly and do need tertiary care ambulatory support to help with ventilation, nutrition, and for subspecialty service involvement.
Good to know that there have been no deaths so far this year. Perhaps that relates to the increased awareness around this. What are you hearing, Peter, from the parents you encounter in clinical practice from day to day? Are they raising this with you? Are they worried about it?
Certainly. I think that there's been a lot of media coverage of this, of acute fasciitis, both in Canada and the United States. And it's certainly a troubling and scary disease, both for families and I think also for clinicians. So again, I think reiterates the importance of early specialty service involvement. So families are worried about this, and I think there's a lot of awareness around this and asking about this. And I think particularly it's challenging because the symptoms of enteroviruses are common cold and gastroenteritis, which we see so often in practice. But it's also important to be reassuring that majority of these infections are mild and uncomplicated, and that acute fasciitis is still incredibly rare, but it's important to give good education so that if they do see any signs of, you know, of a child having weakness in one limb or any abnormal, to see someone soon, and to be, whether that can be a family doctor or a pediatrician or go to the emergency department, just because of the rapidity of these illnesses can progress.
It's rare, and yet the description you give of it is virtually identical to what polio epidemics used to be like. And we've forgotten, I think, being a couple of generations removed from when polio was a regular phenomenon, which we've now prevented with vaccines. But should we be worried that one of these enteroviruses is going to become the new polio and we're going to see pandemics of this arising from one of these evolved enteroviruses? Is that on the horizon from the colleagues you've talked to?
At this stage, it's, I think, too early to make any conclusions. I think certainly with the clusters of cases, there's been associations, but there hasn't been a continual increase in number of cases on an annual basis with an exponential rise. There's been clusters that have come and gone. I think that's certainly something that may evolve, but I think at this stage, it's really, I think I'm unable to comment on that specifically, and that's not something that I feel other people have mentioned so far.
Is there any work being done on a vaccine for this?
So there has been some work done on a vaccine. There's actually been a specific vaccine developed for EVA71, which is known to cause hand, foot, and mouth disease. Unfortunately, this vaccine is not licensed in Canada, but it is used in other countries, mainly to prevent hand, foot, and mouth disease. There is some very early day research done on EVD68 with some research in mouse models, but in terms of anything that would be clinically applicable to humans, I think it's quite a long ways away. But it's important that it's an important area of research. But again, it's challenging because of how common these mild illnesses are and with the rarity of the outcome. But it's certainly an important avenue of research.
Is it known whether the polio vaccine affords any cross protection? For example, has anyone looked at the cases we have of these epidemic acute fasciomyelitis cases to see whether unvaccinated children for polio have had more severe cases than those who've been vaccinated?
It's a good question. And as far as I'm aware of, I've not known of anyone doing that. I think also the challenge with that is that in many of the cases of acute fasciomyelitis, an enterovirus is not isolated from the patient, either from the CSF or from other tissue types. So in often times, there isn't a virus to actually study in the lab to compare with other viruses, which I think is what suggested that it's mainly association with clusters. But I think that's something that if there are more cases that will come in the future, that will be an avenue of research to look if there's any specific similarity with the polio virus. Although at this stage, I think it's unclear whether there is now.
Okay, so Peter, if you have one take-home message to leave clinicians with about acute fasciomyelitis, what would it be?
So the most important thing would be to think about it. You know, this is a condition that it's rare, but if it's not on someone's differential diagnosis, it won't get diagnosed. So clinicians need a high index of suspicion and to think about it in any children that present with common viral prodromal symptoms and vague complaints of pain or weakness.
Thank you very much, Peter, for sharing your expertise with us. And I hope this information will be of help to a lot of our listeners. Thanks for being with us today.
Great. Thanks for having me on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
I've been speaking with Dr. Peter Gill, pediatrician and researcher at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto. To read the Practice article he co-authored, visit cmaj.ca. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, we encourage you to subscribe to CMAJ Podcasts on Apple Podcasts or your favorite app. While you're there, you can browse and listen to our many past episodes, and you can leave us a rating. I'm Dr. Matthew Stanbrook, Deputy Editor for CMAJ. Thank you for listening.